This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a recent victory by the Center for Constitutional Rights involving solitary confinement in California prisons.
Human beings are social creatures. To confine them, as they do in California, alone in an area not much bigger than a toilet, is torture. The California victory is a tremendous first step.
Are charter schools unconstitutional? That's what the Washington State Supreme Court recently ruled.
Because they're using public money undemocratically, this victory might spill over across the country. Another important first step.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, you and Johanna Fernandez and Francis Golden were able to get out to Pennsylvania on Saturday, September 12th, to visit Mumia. How did you find him?
Well, luckily, the day we went to visit Mumia was in very good spirits. Still weak because his condition with his active hepatitis C leaves him some days stronger than others. But it was good to see that he was happy and really glad to see us, and we spent a couple of hours in conversation. So we were able to catch up on a lot of things, and I would say he seemed very happy that we were there.
Apart from his spirits, which is great to hear that they're up, but he's lost some 25 pounds. He's in a serious medical crisis. Hepatitis C is a very dangerous liver disease. What did he look like?
Well, he has lost a lot of weight. He's the thinnest I've ever seen him. I think he'd lost 25 pounds in the last 2 months. His skin is still dark, rough. It's been described as like elephant hide to the touch. The nails on his hands or feet are falling off. The palms of his hands are blackened. And it seems that these conditions are symptoms of his untreated hepatitis C. I would say the most noticeable thing is that he's very thin and weak.
Hepatitis C is a treatable disease. The medicine is expensive. There are some 10,000 Pennsylvania prisoners who have it. Why aren't they giving them the proper medicine?
Well, I can't speak for the Department of Corrections, but it's worth noting that a medical lawsuit was recently filed by Mumia and his legal team charging the Department of Corrections with medical neglect. And we'll see what happens, but I think that the expense is probably a factor. I don't know what the policy is on that.
Grab your pencils, because we're going to give you the names and phone numbers of the two Pennsylvania officials that I think would benefit from calls from all of us out here who are concerned about their denying medicine to Mumia.
Yes, people will remember the name John Wetzel, Secretary of Corrections in Pennsylvania. His number is 717-728-2573, and John Carestes, K-E-R-E-S-T-E-S, who's the superintendent of SCI Mahanoy, where Mumia is currently staying, 570-773-2158. And Michael, it's worth noting that a couple of days before our visit, Mumia, who is still in the hospital infirmary, So he's not in his cell, but most of his possessions were still in his cell. Some of those possessions were packed up and placed into storage. And the concern here is that that might signal a possible transfer to another facility, which would be really ill-advised at this moment, given his health condition. We don't know that, but it seems odd.
And packaging up his cell, I mean, it must be like an office, his cell. He's written how many, 8 books out of his cell. And now they've taken his trade away from him by packaging up everything he relies on.
Yes, well, it certainly contains the possessions that are dear to him, his writings, letters, photographs, all of that.
I want to give these phone numbers out again. The head of the corrections department in Pennsylvania is a man named John Wetzel, and his phone number is 717-728-2573. And the head of the prison where Mumia is John Carestes, and his phone number is 570-773-2158.
After years of litigation by the Center for Constitutional Rights, hunger strikes, and protracted debate, the state of California has finally agreed to move thousands of prison inmates out of solitary confinement. A legal settlement between the state and a group of inmates held in isolation for a decade or more at Pelican State Prison will end the use of solitary confinement to control prison gangs. Jules Lobel, the lead attorney and president of CCR, calls this a dramatic step forward. Legal challenges to the state's reliance on solitary have been mounted since a panel of experts told the state corrections department that the high number of inmates in lengthy isolation did little to improve prison security. The state has agreed to create small, high-security units that house inmates deemed the most dangerous in a group setting, where they are entitled to many of the same privileges as other inmates: contact visits, phone calls, and educational and rehabilitation programs. Inmates found guilty of specified offenses are confined in security housing at Corcoran State Prison. Joining us to talk about this victory is Jules Lobel, who's also a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. Jules Lobel, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
We wanted to start by quoting Dostoevsky. The degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering its prisons. Before 2 weeks ago, can you paint us a picture of what it was like in solitary confinement cells in the state of California?
I can, particularly at Pelican Bay. Pelican Bay is a prison. It's a high-tech prison built about 25 years ago. The cells are 8 foot by 10 foot, which is about twice the size of an American, average American home walk-in closet. There are no windows in the cells. They're just four walls. The prisoner can't put any pictures, basically, in the cell. They spend 23 hours a day in their cells. Their meals are given to them in their cells. They have very little communication with anybody outside of their cell. 1 hour a day, they go to a recreation facility. And I use that word advisedly because the recreation facility is outside, but it has 15-foot-high walls and a grate on the top of it. So you really can't get any sunlight, and you can't see anything in the outside. So these prisoners have been deprived of any environmental stimulation in terms of seeing trees or birds or grass or cars or other people. And many of them had been in this condition for over 20 years. In addition, they had no ability really to contact their families. They couldn't make phone calls. They could only make a phone call in an emergency if one of their parents had died to the next of kin, and that was a 15-minute phone call. They never got to touch their loved ones. They were only able to speak to them if the a family member made the very long trip up to the border between California and Oregon, and from L.A., that was a 14-hour car ride. They then got a couple-hour visit where they spoke over an intercom to the prisoner, seeing them through a glass pane. But we showed that touch is a basic human need, and if people could imagine not being able to touch another human being for 10, 15, or 20 years, that was the condition. It was really high-tech, sophisticated torture.
Jules, this is really one of the great stories of our time. And will you tell us how it unfolded? Because I know it was the prisoners themselves that initiated the whole fight back. And you, as the attorney, came in later in it all. So tell us what happened and how the victory was gained.
This was a prisoner-led movement from beginning to end. The lawyers played a very important role, but an adjunct role to the main actors, who were the prisoners. Back in 2011, having suffered through these conditions for years and years and years, thousands of prisoners in California engaged in two hunger strikes in the summer of 2011. They were brought together by leaders of the four ethnic groups that populate these prisons, namely Southern Hispanics in California, Northern Hispanics, African Americans, and whites. And those leaders came together and called a hunger strike, and also went on to negotiate and agree to what they called an agreement to end hostilities between different ethnic groups, which is an attempt to end violence between different ethnic groups in the California prisons, and eventually they hope to take this to the streets of California and to other jails and detention facilities. It proved wildly successful. The prison officials said they would make reforms but didn't. Some of the prisoners then called upon the Center for Constitutional Rights and myself personally to intervene with a lawsuit, which we did. When still by 2013 there hadn't been any substantial reforms, and our lawsuit was proceeding, but proceeding as lawsuits often do, which is not with the greatest of speed, the prisoners again called for a hunger strike, which lasted for some of them 2 months, in which at the beginning 30,000 prisoners throughout the state of California went on hunger strike demanding an end to prolonged solitary confinement. And a number of them stayed on hunger strike till close to death when the state legislature agreed to look into the conditions and got involved somewhat in trying to expose what California prison officials were doing. Eventually, our lawsuit made a lot of progress, forcing the state of California to come to the table and negotiate. But the negotiating demands were formulated by the prisoners themselves, a meeting in an unprecedented group, which the prison officials refused to allow at first, but we had to get the intervention of the judge to say you have to allow people to meet. They said we're not allowing any collective meetings because we don't have any individuals don't get contact with others. And we said this is a lawsuit. If you want to try to settle it, you have to be willing to have them meet together. So they drew up the demands. We had phone conferences with all of them, going over the negotiations, coming up with our strategy, coming up with our tactics, and eventually ratifying the agreement.
Jules, is Pelican Bay an anomaly in this country? And is it true that part of the reason so many inmates were housed in solitary was related to alleged gang affiliation?
Right. Well, I'll take the second question first. Thousands of prisoners in California have been put in long-term solitary for having some affiliation, not even being a member, but having some affiliation with a gang. And that could be shown by artwork that they drew, which the gang officials said represent affiliation with a gang, tattoos, being found on some membership list, having their name found on some membership list, having political literature that officials said was gang-related, having a photograph with somebody who they thought was a gang member, or having communication with other alleged gang members. And California took the position that I first came across in West Side Story, that once you're a gang member from the beginning of your life to the end of your life, and therefore there was no way out, really. So that's the first thing about it. So the people put in solitary were not because they had committed some vicious crime, either outside of prison or even or inside the prison, but simply because of their affiliation with a gang. And this settlement stops that practice, stops it dead in its tracks. And second, is this an anomaly? Well, Pelican Bay is one of the worst places in the country, but as we speak, it's estimated that 80,000 to 100,000 prisoners around the country are in solitary confinement. And for the past 20 to 25 years, states have been building these high-tech supermax prisons, which hold hundreds, if not thousands, of prisoners. And they've been doing this in Ohio and Virginia, all around the country. So Colorado, the federal system has a supermax. And they're basically all on the same order, 23 hours a day lockup in your cell with very little activities, programming, educational opportunities, communication with other people, and no touch with other people. So while Pelican Bay, in some respects, was one of the worst, having no windows, there are many places around the country which approximate the conditions of Pelican Bay.
Attorney Jules Lobel, I understand that in California, prior to your victory, there had been some 500 prisoners that had been in solitary confinement for over 10 years, and another 78 who had been in solitary for over 20 years. And this was a great victory, but it was, in my estimation, a beginning, because there's still stuff to do. So I'd like you to talk about the aspects of the victory and what remains to be done.
Yeah, our plaintiffs, when ratifying this agreement, made a statement, and the statement they made was that this is an important first step in eventually abolishing prolonged solitary confinement in this country, but it's only a first step. What the settlement does is it gets rid of putting people into solitary for gang membership or affiliation. You're going to have to commit some serious offense in prison to get into solitary, which is a major victory in that it'll dramatically reduce the numbers of people in solitary. And it could be a model for around the country. The other thing it does is gets rid of indefinite solitary confinement. You'll be, if you commit a murder or an assault in prison, you'll be given some set term in solitary confinement, but not what happened in the past, which led to 500 people being in Pelican Bay for over 10 years and close to 80 for over 20 years, which is that the solitary just went on and on and on with no set term. So that'll end this. It'll also review all the people who are in solitary, and almost all of them, unless they've committed some serious murder or assault while they've in the last year or two, will get out, which is a major victory for thousands of prisoners. And finally, it set up an alternative to solitary. I mean, there are some people in prison who we have to face the facts are very dangerous. Maybe there's some pathological killers or people who really present a danger. And my clients and the leaders of the hunger strike didn't feel that those people they didn't feel that the state should be precluded from doing anything with those folks. They should just not treat them in a cruel and inhumane way. So those people can be segregated from the general population, but shouldn't be isolated, shouldn't be deprived of a basic human need. And so California agreed to set up a unit which would segregate people who they thought were dangerous or were at some risk for their own personal safety or had committed a lot of violations, but give them a restrictive environment, but with small group programming, with small group activities, with small group recreation, with contact visits with their families, with phone calls, so that they wouldn't be totally isolated and considerably more out of cell time than the 1 hour a day that was given in the past. And we're hoping that this could be a model for the treatment of the small group of prisoners, not the thousands that require solitary confinement, but the handful of prisoners who should be separated from the general population.
Jules, I'm sure you know that Juan Mendez, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, has proposed a worldwide ban on most uses, nearly all uses of solitary, which has been apparently on the increase around the world, especially because of the so-called war on terror and allegations that there may be threats to national security. Does the U.S. rank high in terms of putting more persons in solitary?
I think we have a one of the worst uses or the most problematic uses of solitary confinement. And it's, I think, akin and parallel to the tremendous rise of mass incarceration in this country for the last 30 years. As we put more and more people in jail, often for minor crimes, we've also used solitary more and more, often for minor infractions, like in this case of California gang affiliation. So it's really a parallel to the tremendous rise of mass incarceration in this country. And just as we have a higher percentage of our population in prison than any country in the world, so too we have a higher percentage of our prisoners in solitary than other countries in the world. And Juan Mendez said you shouldn't use it for more than 15 days. He was one of our experts in California. He wrote a devastating report of what California was doing. And I guess in response to your question, he said he's traveled all around the world visiting prisons, and in no other country has he found prisons which use solitary for this long a period of time on this many people for such weak justifications.
Jules, in your pleadings, the Eighth Amendment outlaws cruel and unusual punishment. You allege that. Did you get a ruling on that? And did you get a ruling on due process?
We got a ruling denying the state their motion to dismiss. That's not a ruling on the merits, but it said that we had stated a claim, which suggests that anyway we had a viable claim. Our clients would have liked to have gotten a ruling, but the settlement presented such a major victory, and it presented it without going through 4 or 5 years of appeals, so it presented a victory now as opposed to many years in the future. Our clients decided it was worth it to settle as opposed to trying to win it after trial.
No, absolutely. But I understand that Justice Kennedy on the United States Supreme Court may be leaning towards saying that solitary is torture and violates the Eighth Amendment. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Justice Kennedy gave a speech to a hearing of a committee of Congress in which he suggested that solitary confinement was very, very troubling and could violate cruel and unusual punishment. And he wrote a concurring opinion in a case that involved the death penalty, an inmate on death row, which didn't really raise the issue of solitary confinement, but which Kennedy, in concurrence, went out of his way to say he thought this raised serious problems under the Eighth Amendment, and he invited, essentially, prisoners to litigate this issue up to the Supreme Court.
Jules, are you currently involved in any other similar cases?
There are some efforts in other states, but nothing that has been filed yet.
Jules, would it be optimistic to suggest that we're seeing a trend in the United States toward repealing what have been a series of really overly punitive laws, probably dating back to the 60s?
Yeah, I think that there's been a revulsion and a backlash against the harshness of our criminal justice system generally, and in particular the use of solitary confinement. In 50 years, we're going to look back at this and say, how could we have done this to people? The Prison Guards Association, the day after we settled, Correctional Officials Association came out with a statement criticizing the use of solitary confinement. President Obama has criticized it. Justice Kennedy has criticized it. I think our settlement is the beginning of the death knell for solitary confinement.
Amen. You know, Frederick Douglass famously said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did. It never will. I think that you could say this certainly illustrates what great Douglass observed 100-some years ago.
I think that's absolutely true.
Jules, you must personally feel elated with this. Were you ever in doubt that you would have a positive result?
I felt in the deepest part of my soul that we were going to win this case. It was seen as a very tough case at the beginning, and it was a very tough road and a tough struggle. And I feel tremendous for the families, the thousands of families who have been supporting their loved ones in prison, for the prisoners, and for our legal team and all the supporters.
Well, bravo to all of you, Jules.
Jules LaBelle, you're the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and you've done all of us proud. Thank you.
Thank you for interviewing me.
Bye-bye, Jules.
Bye-bye.
So long.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
After nearly a year of deliberation, the Washington State Supreme Court recently ruled 6-3 that charter schools are unconstitutional. The ruling is believed to be the first of its kind in the country and overturns the law voters narrowly approved in 2012, allowing publicly funded but privately operated schools. In the ruling, Chief Justice Barbara Madsen wrote that charter schools aren't so-called common schools because they're governed by appointed rather than elected boards. Therefore, she wrote, money that is dedicated to common schools is unconstitutionally diverted to charter schools. Lawyers from the Attorney General's office are reviewing the decision, as is the Governor's office. Here to discuss the decision and the ongoing debate over charter schools across the nation is educator and CUNY professor Michelle Fine, co-author of Charter Schools and the Corporate Makeover of Public Education, What's at Stake? Michelle Fine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We'd like to start with a brief explanation, if you will, of what is a charter school.
Charter schools are a phenomenon that have popped up around the United States over the last couple of decades. They started in Minnesota as a public sector alternative to district schools. It started out as a progressive imaginary for what schooling could be that was still public, but not bound by the strictures of local districts. So early on in the charter school movement, the big distinction was that even though they got public dollars, they were governed by a board that was not of the local district. So a bunch of social justice charter schools popped up throughout the country, Oakland, New York, Philadelphia, etc. Soon thereafter, as is true with many kind of rich alternatives in the public sector, privatizing interests decided that there was a profit to be made. And so soon thereafter, a kind of industry of charter schools started emerging. You'll remember that after Hurricane Katrina, Arne Duncan, Secretary of Education, said Katrina might have been the best thing to happen for public education in New Orleans because they basically shut down the majority of the traditional public schools and in their place built systems of privately run charter schools. The current circumstances is that I would say we're in a kind of conceptual morass and a legal morass about what are the critical elements that assure that a school is public. Just receiving public dollars cannot be sufficient because these schools are now not governed by the taxpayers. They are not transparent with respect to their finances. They are often not following the same laws and rules with respect to access for special education students, etc. They're usually not unionized, and they tend not to be transparent about their data. So there's been a lot of accusations of creaming and throwing kids out. So right now we're in a hybrid moment. So this this decision from Washington State actually comes at a quite wonderful time.
You anticipated our next question, Michelle. Several weeks ago, the highest court in the state of Washington outlawed charter schools, saying that they weren't sufficiently democratic or public. Talk to us about that.
Washington has been hot around educational justice. Just today or last night, they settled the Seattle teacher strike also.
Yay, we didn't know that.
Yeah, reducing the amount of not only around salary and benefits, but reducing the amount of testing, insisting that teachers get professional development around restorative justice to reduce racial disparities. So, you know, we've got to listen to our brothers and sisters in the West a little more. The charter school decision in Washington was, I would say, the first shot, legal shot across the bow, raising real questions about are charter schools public. The particulars in Washington, and again, I'm not a lawyer, the particulars are that charter schools in Washington were deemed unconstitutional because they do not fit the definition of a common school. That is, they are not governed by the taxpayers who are supporting the institution. And so as a consequence, the court argued that these are not public schools, shouldn't be receiving public dollars. I think lawyers, educators, trade unionists, parents around the country were very excited because in the name of charter, districts like New Orleans, Detroit, Chicago, heavily black, low-income Latino districts are simply being dismantled with local schools being closed and then flipped as charters. And then in the case of Chicago, when the charter doesn't work out, flipped as real estate.
Yeah, I know they're making condos.
So exactly. This is one of those Gloria Anzaldúa streams where there are lots of currents. There was a racial justice current giving people who had been denied good education an alternative. Then came the current of profit and real estate and selective admissions and selectively throwing kids out. So the justices in Washington really opened up a very, very important can of worms around what makes a charter school public. I was the co-director of Initiative in Philadelphia, where large comprehensive high schools were turned into small schools. This was early in the charter movement, and they were called charters. And they had some of the kind of early progressive commitments of racial justice, detracking, giving alternatives, different kind of governance of the charter school movement.
Michelle Fine, you and Michael Fabricant wrote a significant book called Charter Schools and the Corporate Makeover of Public Education, What's at Stake? And in the book, you talk about the movement towards market-driven public sphere. It reflects the nation's weakening of, quote, commitment to shared faiths, democratic participation, and concerns for equity and deep accountability. And I wanted you to put that in the context of the privatization of so many other formerly public institutions in our country.
Yeah, it's like Prince, formerly known as public. Indeed, we are, as you all know, in a neoliberal moment where we are witnessing what some call the shrinkage of the public sphere. I would call it the realignment. Because it's not actually that the dollars of the public sphere have shrunk, but they are being redirected away from community development, racial justice, and redirected toward policing, military, war, incarceration, privatization, contracts, high technology. So if you just sat in Chicago or in New York, in a low-income black community over the last 10 years, you will have watched local schools be closed, presumably because of inadequate academic outcomes. These are the same schools that have been disinvested in for decades. Communities have been complaining about the quality of the schools. They were neglected until, you know, go to the Upper West Side. Brandeis High School was neglected until you got a majority white and elite community moving into the neighborhood. Then they decided to close Brandeis High School, reopen it as a series of schools, one of which is the Success Academy that Eva Moskowitz is associated with, another of which is a selective private school with very rigorous admission criteria. So we're watching a kind of refashioning of public institutions, whether it's social welfare, healthcare, housing, education, libraries, Social Security, Medicaid. But in some ways, education was the last holdout, and it feels so sad. We already know that kind of when I say public hospital, you know that's for a group of people, not all people. If I say public housing, you know that's for low-income folks. When we say public education, we have presumed in this country, and it was always not quite true, that it was for all. That is increasingly being dismantled by a privatization campaign that is closing local schools, taking them out of the hands of local communities, reopening them as charters, putting them in the hands of corporate or not-for-profit organizations. Typically, where CEOs are making a lot of money, where the staff are not unionized, where the kids are African-American or Latino, but not the poorest, not special ed, not English language learners, and the numbers of children who are taken into the building and then removed from the building, that is thrown out, that is encouraged to go back to their neighborhood school, are very, very high. I refer you to the work of Bruce Baker, who's been looking at how charter schools are deselecting students.
And I wanted to ask a bit about that, Michelle. Is that the term that you referred to earlier called creaming?
Yeah. Well, creaming is on the front end. So to get into a charter school, your parent has to enroll you in a lottery. Have you seen the film Waiting for Superman?
Not yet.
It's old, but it's like edu porn. You know, it's like you've got 700 low-income African-American parents in an auditorium waiting for a lottery for, I forget if it was 70 or 120 slots. It's torturous to watch. And so you've got creaming coming in, that is, who are the parents who understand a lottery? You've got much lower rates of special education students. You have much lower rates of educationally struggling students, much lower rates of English language learners. And the data from Bruce Baker in New Jersey is you have reduced lunch students, but much lower rates of free lunch students. So the poorest students are being, and the most struggling students are being creamed coming in. And then once they're in, the kind of push-out rate, the I would encourage you to go back to your local school because we don't have the resources to take care of your needs rate, are quite high. So again, I refer people to Bruce Baker's data online. He's at Rutgers University. He's been tracking who's coming into charter schools and who's being deselected. So when charter schools declare victory on, you know, all of our graduates are going to college, that might be the case, but those are not the same kids who started in ninth grade for the most part.
You know, I know that you're not totally against charter schools, but you conclude that charter schools, the experience has been is that they're not really any better or any worse than public schools. So what I'm curious about is why has the charter movement enjoyed such political success?
So let me say three things. One is some of my best friends are charter schools, right? And there's huge variation. There are some beautiful social justice, mama, papa, honest, progressive charter schools. Where the heavy critique is emerging is on the big chains and networks that are moving into communities, not addressing the needs of local students and selecting the less struggling students. And where the major critique is being lodged is in places like New Orleans, or now Newark, New Jersey, where there's a big fight on, or Chicago, where you're getting the charter sector basically replacing the public school sector, or leaving behind so many needy students that folks who are working in or sending their children to public schools feel like they're really working with the students who have been left behind. On the other hand, charter schools are the darling of investment bankers, of the finance industry, of the technology industry. They get lots of money from Gates Foundation, Walton Foundation, Broad Academy, the kind of DFER, Democrats for Education Reform. The charter school movement is a place where Republicans and Democrats come together pretty comfortably. And I would say some of that is about attacks on public sector. Some of it is attacks on teachers' union. Some of it is hating teachers' pensions and kind of taking advantage of a long and painful history of miseducation in the Black community. So kind of leeching off of Black pain to dismantle what was and create the charter industry. Du Bois wrote about this 100 years ago, that the moans of the darker race would only be attended to when there was a profit to be made. And I'm worried that that's the moment we're in. But certainly they get good media. They get lots of money, they get good press from politicians, and they have extraordinary lobbyists.
The name Eva Moskowitz was mentioned earlier in the show, and I've read some things about her efforts here in New York City. Could you tell us about what she's trying to accomplish and why she's drawn so much criticism?
Sure. You know, in some ways, Eva Moskowitz is like the Uber of the charter school movement, right? So she's become the symbol of the ambitious success academy system that has really successfully dislodged a number of local public schools and replaced them with success academy charter schools. Again, you've got the same issues with parents having to enter lotteries, lower rates of special ed, lower rates of free lunch, high rates of deselecting students. And so when Mayor de Blasio came in, he went after Success Academy hard. And then Andrew Cuomo came in and absolutely defended the Success Academy's right to be co-located in existing public schools. So the co-location becomes a particular issue in New York because people end up feeling like the resources are not evenly distributed between the charter and the public schools.
Yeah, exactly.
Michelle, the Washington State decision is, I believe, the first of its kind in this nation. Do you think that we'll be seeing more challenges to the constitutionality of charter schools?
I do. You know, what's interesting about the Washington decision is that the case was brought by a very diverse group of constituencies. It was brought by the League of Women Voters, the Teachers Union, the Principals Union, La Raza, and the original law was heavily financed by Bill Gates. And I think we are seeing so much pushback from parents, from civic groups, from educators, from civil rights groups, from immigration groups, against charters and for public schools. I am no apologist for public schools. I've spent 30 years writing about the racialized injustices that our public schools have perpetrated. But, you know, I taught at University of Pennsylvania for 12 years, and I left there to come to CUNY because we've got to contribute to spaces where all of our faiths are shared, where all of our resources are dedicated to our collective well-being and not just creaming off a kind of talented tenth. That's not good for our collective well-being. It's certainly not a way to respond to racial injustice. So I do think that you're going to start to see lawsuits that will reproduce the Washington case, which is this is not a common school. I think that's a possible avenue in New York. It's not an avenue, as I understand it, the way the law is written in New Jersey. But I think people are starting to say, well, what makes this public? Is it who pays the taxes? Is it who governs it? Is it whether or not the school is responsive to special education law? Is it transparency of finances? Is it responsibility to accept a broad range of students and keep them? So I think the question of what constitutes a public school is going to come under legal scrutiny. And I think the special ed community, the English learner community, lawyers and trade unions are really taking a hard look as we watch particularly low-income communities get kind of hollowed out in terms of having local public schools that they can call their neighborhood school. We're also seeing at the same time an enormous rise in commitments to community schools, you know, to having schools as major democratic institutions, full service, in communities where people can learn English, they can take parenting classes, they can play basketball. Public schools are the last public institution in low-income communities. The libraries are gone. The hospitals are disappearing. The only other public institutions in low-income communities are the cops and the military recruiters. That's deep. Deep. So people are demanding to have their public democratic, always unfinished, always a work in progress, public school back in their neighborhood.
Michelle, we're running out of time. Any parting thoughts on this subject?
I guess the last thing I would say is maybe this Washington case is like Goodridge v. Department of Public Health in Massachusetts, which was the first state decision that opened up, that wedged open a conversation about same-sex marriage. And I think in the same way, the Washington decision is cracking open a much-needed conversation about just because tax dollars are being used does not make these schools public, and we've got to have regulations on them and accountability for them.
Well said. Michelle Fine, it's been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder, and we hope to stay in touch.
Thank you all. See
Thanks.
You.
Thanks so much, Michelle.
Yeah, bye-bye. Pleasure. To be continued. See
you. Absolutely.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Oh,